funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. The House of Alba is the very definition of old money. The first person to hold the title the Count of Alba received it 50 years before Columbus ever set foot in North America. The family's fortunes rose with Spain's as the country conquered the New World, and the Albas became one of Spain's largest landowners. Even today, the Albas own two palaces in Madrid, one in Seville, and another in Salamanca. And those palaces house one of Europe's great art collections. With me today to talk about the Albas, their place in Spanish history, and the artworks currently on display at the Meadows Museum are Alexandra Willemsen, a professor at the University of Dallas and the historian in the university's interdisciplinary Spanish program. She has taught at the University of Dallas since 1971. And Kenneth Andrian, who holds the Edmund and Louise Kahn Chair in History at SMU and is co-author of the recent book, The Spanish Atlantic World in the 18th Century. Alexandra, Kenneth, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
Before we try to give some outline to the House of Alba and its complicated history, I want to go straight to the exhibition to give listeners just a little idea of why this show is such a remarkable event, regardless if we know anything about Spanish nobility. Alexandra, when I first spoke to you a few weeks ago about this exhibition, you were extremely interested in two paintings in particular. If just those two were on display, you felt this would be a landmark show. Which two paintings and why?
Well, I was very excited to see paintings that I had seen reproduced in books for many, many, many years, to know that they were actually coming to town and I could see the real paintings. One was the 13th Duchess of Alba by Goya, which seems to be the painting that is featured in this exhibit. And the other was the double portrait of Emperor Charles V and his wife Isabel, who was a Portuguese princess.
Now, why were you so interested in them if you could see them in reproductions?
Well, a little tiny reproduction in a book is not anything like the real thing.
And so they simply weren't available to be seen.
No, because they're part of a private collection. And so the Albas had made photographs possible, obviously available decades ago. And historians have used these in their books and art historians also. But I've never been into the Lidia Palace in Madrid where they are usually kept.
So you've lived in Spain, but even then you couldn't see these.
I think if one writes ahead and asks for permission, it's possible, but I had never done that. Most people don't.
In addition to those works, there are more than 130 items on view. And frankly, the show can be a bit overwhelming. There are paintings by Rubens, Goya, John Singer Sargent. There are drawings by Rembrandt, three of the most famous engravings by Albrecht Dürer. But the show has more than artworks in it. There are also historic documents from what's been called Spain's Golden Age. And these documents include ones written by Christopher Columbus himself. And Kenneth, could you explain a little of the context and the significance?
Well, I think it's important because, first of all, we know very little about Christopher Columbus. He's produced a certain amount of documentation, but he was not a person of the aristocracy. And so we don't have any painting of Christopher Columbus. And as a consequence, the documents that we see here, particularly the list of those who took part in the expedition in 1492, are a window into that moment. And so for that reason, people who are not historians who are just fascinated by any kind of documentation by Columbus.
There's also from that period, there are documents basically presenting a coat of arms to some of the more famous conquistadors like Pizarro. What did that signify? Was that basically making them noblemen?
Yes, making them noblemen in law, but not in not in society. In a sense, one of the things that's interesting about the conquistadors is they were either members of the lower nobility or, in many cases, members of the middle class. And so this kind of ennoblement was really to change their status in recognition of what they'd done. But in Spain itself, there was always a sense in which the Pizarros were suspect. They had, after all, been responsible for regicide, killing the Inca Atahualpa at Cajamarca. And so there was always a sense that they were on the shady side of things.
A little dangerous?
A little dangerous and ne'er-do-wells.
Just to give some idea of the significance of these documents, I read that one letter by Columbus, owned by the Albas, not in this exhibition, was going to be auctioned until a Spanish court declared that it is essentially was a national treasure. It could not leave the country. So that gives you an idea, I think, of the fact that there are three documents related to Columbus in his hand. And one of them is a map, supposedly, of Haiti. But there's some dispute about
it. Well, there's some dispute about it because it's a fragmentary map to start out with. And the question really is, could Columbus at that time have had enough topographical knowledge to have been able to produce a map? And so there's some question about it, although he was someone who was quite familiar with navigation and various techniques that were needed to produce maps.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are historians Alexander Willemsen and Kenneth Andrian, and we're talking about the House of Alba, the landmark art exhibition at SMU's Meadows Museum. Please join the conversation. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org. Now, these documents come from Spain's Golden Age, roughly the period from Ferdinand and Isabella through Philip II, the Spanish Armada. Before this, the House of Alba was just another noble family, basically wealthy landowners with a title. But this is when they truly begin to achieve significant power. And I was wondering, Kenneth, if you could talk a little bit about the third Duke of Alba, known as the Grand Duke, but also the Iron Duke.
Right. The third Duke of Alba was probably Spain's most important military figure of the 16th century. He was also part of a political faction. There were two major political factions in the court of Philip II, and he was the leader of one of them. And as a consequence, he was important not only for his military genius, but also even more so for his organizational skills as a military leader. And then secondarily because of his political power and his influence over the king.
Why did he become known as the Iron Duke and in some places a rather reviled figure?
Well, he earned that reputation by his actions in the Netherlands. He was essentially sent over by King Philip II to put down the revolt of the Netherlands. It began in 1566.
This is when Spain controlled the Netherlands.
Right. It was actually part of the Habsburg family's hereditary possessions. And there were two reasons why the Netherlands were so important. It was the traditional home of his father, Charles V, and it was also one of the major producers of textiles that in Spain sold most of its wool to the Netherlands. So it had economic importance, familial importance, and strategic importance.
And it also had a religious dispute going on.
There was a religious dispute going on, but it's interesting because this is one of the limitations of the sort of blinders of the great Duke of Alba. He saw this very much as a religious rebellion, and he saw the people that he was dealing with as heretics. And he treated them with great brutality at various points.
This is the Spain representing the Catholic Church and
exactly.
The Netherlands being Protestant.
But there were even cases where Catholic cities had rebelled against the Spaniards, and the Duke treated them as heretics as well, putting the largest number of the citizens to death, for example. So he's reviled in the history of the Netherlands, and he is seen as one of the central figures in the way in which Spain is perceived as being sort of cruel, backward, intolerant. And he's seen almost as a sort of the archetype of that bad Spaniard.
And it starts way back in the 16th century. The Duke is not personally ruthless, but he feels that this is the demands of his faith.
Right. I think that's an apt summary of what he would have thought. He was also a man who was very, very formal. He was not given to great humor, no self-deprecating humor in the great Duke of Alba. He was, as I said, a formal, sophisticated man. He was well-educated. He was tutored by some of the leading intellectuals as a young man. So he was not sort of anti-intellectual at all, but he is firmly convinced of the rectitude of his actions when he's putting down what he sees to be Protestant heretics.
Alexander, there's a small gallery in which two portraits of the Duke face each other. Could you talk a little bit about them?
I think the people at the Meadows Museum have tried to duplicate or replicate what the Duchess of Alba, who just died a few months ago, had in her house. In other words, the the current Duke. They have a room dedicated to the great Duke, and they have those two paintings, one in each corner, almost looking at one another. And in one, the Duke is about 40 years old, and in the other, you can see he's aged quite a bit.
The early one is by Rubens.
Exactly. And the other one is by a Flemish painter. I think they're both fantastic, but I had never seen, or I hadn't seen very many copies, duplicates of the one in which he's younger, and I really like that.
But he's still, I mean, especially in the older one, he looks like a tough customer.
Very formal, very proper. This is a man who was raised by his grandfather because his father died very young fighting the Muslims in North Africa. And he traveled all over Europe with his father. He spoke four or five different languages. As Dr. Andrian just said, he knew many of the great intellectuals of his time. He was no country bumpkin. You know, there were many aspects to the third Duke of Alba, not just the great military hero or the man who tried to put down the rebellion in the Netherlands. There were many aspects to him.
Which brings up an interesting point. We tend to think of counts and dukes throughout history as having always collected art, but that's not true. And it's really only in this period, the Golden Age of Spain, that the Albas start collecting art. Why? What's changed?
Probably the Renaissance, the great interest in art that developed during the Renaissance. Also, I might say that in the Middle Ages, the Spaniards, the Christians in Spain, spent so much of their energy fighting the Muslims that they were not able to put emphasis on the quality of life until pretty late. I mean, most of their energy went into survival until Muslim Spain was reduced to a very small area around Granada. And so I think that maybe it's possible that the Spaniards got a late start in that sense.
But you mentioned the Renaissance, part of the training of a courtier, like the great Duke, would be the idea that you're not a fulfilled person unless you appreciate art.
Right. Also, of course, the Kingdom of Aragon, which is part of the Iberian Peninsula, one of the Hispanic kingdoms, ruled a good part of Italy. And many Spaniards went to Italy at this time. And, of course, Italy was producing so many beautiful things. And, in fact, our third Duke of Alba was Spanish viceroy in Naples for a while. And another Alba a couple of generations later was also, there's a street, a main avenue in Naples called Via Toledo in memory
Toledo.
Of this family. Right. And so I think going to Italy, so many Spanish soldiers went to Italy, so many diplomats, merchants, and they imbibed some of the Renaissance.
And they also made kinship alliances with members of the Italian nobility in various places. The Alba family had lots of Italian connections, for example. And so this cultural interchange would have been something that was a natural outgrowth of the way the family itself conducted its business as well as its politics.
Despite figures like the Grand Duke of Alba, the Albas never became a royal family, which is probably why they're not better known outside of Spain. So they're not like the Bourbons, the Habsburgs, or the Romanovs. They never were kings or queens. But perhaps because of that, by the 19th and 20th centuries, they're generally doing better than those families, mostly because many of those families are killed in battle or executed or overthrown or whatever. But how did the... We'll have to come to this after the break, but think about how do the Albas survive, endure, and succeed into the 21st century? I'm Jerome Weeks. We're talking about the House of Alba at the SMU's Meadows Museum, and we'll be right back after this break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, a customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA, and I'm Jerome Weeks, in for Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are historians Alexander Willemsen and Kenneth Andrian, and we're talking about the House of Alba, the landmark art exhibition at SMU's Meadows Museum. Please join the conversation. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org. And right before the break, I was asking why the Albas, why the Alba family, despite never becoming royalty, could account 500 years of art collecting in their history. How have they survived?
Well, I think advantageous marriages was one. In other words, as each generation went by, an Alba married another aristocrat who had a fine inheritance, and that has allowed them over the generations to acquire more land than any aristocratic family in Spain. Also, they had a policy of, with very few exceptions over many generations, of being loyal to the crown and not rebellious. They've had a tendency not to get involved in politics unless absolutely necessary. They've always wanted to serve their nation as ambassadors, in cultural ways, as heads of different organizations, but they've tried to stay out of politics.
So they did not seem to have an ideological bent at any particular point.
Well, if they did, they did not go to bat for it the way some Spaniards did. I mean, in the 19th century, there were 5 civil wars in Spain. People took sides. You know, well, you don't see the Albas as rebels the way many others were.
I think you can say that they were religious, conservative by and large, and interested in culture and the arts, particularly in the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just to put it a little bit more specificity about this. I mean, they married into some of the biggest noble families in Europe, including the last marriage when the last duchess died in Alvarez de Toledo family died in 1802. The title then passed to the Dukes of Berwick, which were members of the nobility from Scotland in their own right. So now you have this union of these two major families in this one particular way. And it was really the Dukes of Berwick that were among those who were most interested in collecting art and went back over the 19th, particularly in the 20th century, and added so greatly to this collection of the family art. Much of the family art of the original Alvarez de Toledo family was sort of scattered after the death of the Duchess in 1802.
And the Berwick family is the illegitimate wing of the Stuarts from Scotland.
Exactly, yeah, Fitz James Stuarts.
The Catholic branch of the family.
Back to the exhibition itself. Not all of the Alba family over the years were art collectors, really only a major handful. And so the show, although it's set up more or less chronologically, is actually arranged around these individual collectors. And I have to say, visitors may find that a little confusing. You pass by 18th century artworks into the next gallery, and there are Renaissance artworks. So it's not strictly speaking chronologically. It's chronologically by the Duke who was collecting the works. Alexandra, there is one work that comes at you completely out of chronological order, but it's an absolute stunner. And I think you know the one I mean.
The Frangelico. Yes, yes. And that was collected in, like you said, in the early 19th century. It entered the Alba collection by one of the early men who had both the title Duke of Alba and Duke of Berwick. And he spent many years in Italy buying works of art. And that's an absolutely gorgeous piece. And I think the current Duke, the 19th Duke of Alba, considers that to be the jewel of the family collection.
When you enter that gallery, you see that face on, that Fra Angelico, early Renaissance painting, and it is just, I mean, it's stunningly displayed, and the detail, it's also amazingly preserved. I mean, the condition, it looks like it was painted yesterday.
Yeah, beautiful, absolutely gorgeous.
You can see why it does shine like a jewel in the work. But it is, as I said, sort of amazing to come from one gallery and then see the Fra Angelico standing alone like that. In the Spanish Civil War, jumping ahead in the 1930s, General Francisco Franco destroys the Spanish Republic and takes power. But Franco is not really a fascist like Adolf Hitler. He doesn't impose the same kind of modern totalitarian state. So some of the real winners of the Spanish Civil War are the great landowners like the Albas. And in fact, the 17th Duke of Alba served as Franco's ambassador to London. But Alexandra, you've told me the Duke's relationship with the Franco regime was actually a little more antagonistic than that appointment would seem to indicate.
Yes, because the Dukes of Alba were monarchists. They were very loyal to the exiled royal family. And it's my understanding that the 17th Duke agreed – well, he was living in – he had fled Spain because during the war he was in England. And Franco asked him to be ambassador. And he agreed because, of course, he was patriotic. But he wanted the monarchy to be restored. And after some years, he saw it wasn't happening. And so he handed in his resignation.
So, but the Albas weren't necessarily punished by Franco because of that.
I think the Duke had had his passport removed for a few months. There was a little bit of bad feelings, but they got over it. I mean, Franco needed the Albas because this was the premier family of aristocrats in the country. And likewise, they were patriotic. And so for the time being, Franco was the government.
So Franco, the Albas gave Franco some legitimacy in a way.
To a certain extent. But again, you know, the ambassador handed in his resignation. I think it was in 45 when he saw that Franco was taking an awfully long time to bring back the exiled royal family.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, in for Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are historians Alexander Willemsen and Kenneth Andrian. And we're talking about the House of Alba, the landmark art exhibition at SMU's Meadows Museum. Please join the conversation. You can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org. We were talking earlier about the Fra Angelico and how it was acquired. I think that was the 14th Duke, and he was on what was called the Grand Tour. If you could talk a little bit, what was that?
Well, the Grand Tour was a visit to Italy, especially Italy and other places, made by aristocrats and well-to-do people after they had finished college or the equivalent of college. Go see things, go see beautiful things and learn on the spot. And the Grand Tour for high-ranking aristocrats would be a year or two. But for this man, he was there about 10 years, I think.
And he became one of the great collectors. I mean, it was probably one of the more rewarding Grand Tours in history because
yes.
He comes back with this hoard of paintings. I mean, Titians, Rembrandts, you name it. He brought back a lot of souvenirs.
Exactly. Well, after the death of the 13th Duchess, the lady whose picture is one of the main paintings in this exhibit, she died without children. And she left a lot of her possessions to distant relatives, to friends, to servants. And so when the title of Duke of Alba went to a second or third cousin of hers, the Berwick family, they, I think, felt that they needed to reconstruct a little bit. They needed to make up for the loss of a good number of the beautiful family paintings.
Well, we bring up the famous Duchess of Goya's. The painting is famous not simply because it's a Goya painting. Why?
Well, personally, I have seen so many photographs of the late Duchess posing in front of that painting in her palace. They had the same name, Cayetana. And so the present Duke's mother, who died just a few months ago, frequently was seen in magazine articles and in books posing in front of that painting, the two Cayetanas. Also, there have only been three women in the 600 years of the duchy who have inherited the titles. It's usually been, of course, a man inherits the title and then he marries somebody and she's the duchess. But there were three who inherited the titles themselves. And the Cayetana in the painting and the Cayetana, who just died, were two of those three. It's, of course, famous also because Goya painted a number of pictures of this lady and of her husband. But there have been all kinds of myths romanticizing the relationship between Goya and the 13th Duchess, and that may be one of the reasons that people are interested. Also, we've seen other paintings by Goya of this Duchess in museums. This one is private property. People are eager, I think, to see it. When I was there the other day, a lady was standing next to me, a Peruvian lady, and she said, "Oh, for so long I've seen this in books. I'm so glad to see the real thing." I said, "Same here. That's exactly how I feel."
And it's sizable. It's a full-length portrait,
yes.
So it's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. But it is true that the rumors that circulated was that she and Goya were lovers.
Mm-hmm. Well, she was single at the time. Her husband had died. She was a notoriously attractive woman. That if you look at the pictures, she doesn't have classic good looks. But people at the time remarked about how she was just an extremely desirable woman. And she knew how to dress. She knew how to project herself. And she was also sort of a playful person, too. She had a kind of playful rivalry with the queen. At one point, the queen bought some clothing. And she, Cayetana, bought the same kinds of clothing for her relatives, for her servants, rather. And she had them wear it publicly so that the queen would see it.
Something of an insult?
Yeah, a little bit. It's an insult, but it's not anything that's going to get you into trouble. It's a little bit of sort of, we might say cattiness.
Playfulness.
Yeah, playfulness or cattiness, right.
Cattiness, okay.
A little both.
So her husband dies. She never remarries? She has no children.
And she has no children. She dies at 40, which also produced some, that was sort of shrouded mystery. There was some concern that perhaps she'd been poisoned. And actually, they exhumed the body to see whether this was true and found out that, no, she seems to have died of tuberculosis.
When did they exhume the body?
It was in the 20th century, and I'm not sure exactly the date for it, but one of the dukes wanted to put this one to rest.
So another tuberculosis death in the 18th, 19th century is
right.
Fairly common.
1802, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other painting of her this is the one in white. There's another painting of her all in black.
Yes, I think that's at the Hispanic Society in New York, isn't it?
It is. I've seen it. It's mm-hmm. quite stunning.
Yeah, I have too.
What is that outfit called? Isn't she wearing a kind of peasant outfit?
Well, it's called maja, but right. I think it's sort of halfway in between.
Now, what is the significance
of anyway,
that?
But anyway, a popular, not an aristocratic or not an elegant French
So she was dressing a little street.
Mm-hmm.
At the top of the show, I said that the Albas are the very definition of old money, but that can mean quaint anachronism or it can mean the real power behind the scenes. How are the Albas perceived today in Spain?
Well, you know, for people who inherit such an enormous amount of wealth, they're very popular. Most aristocrats who inherit a lot of wealth keep a low profile because they know this is not the age of aristocracy, and there are a lot of people who are very envious. There are a lot of people who don't really believe that people should inherit a lot of wealth. You know, we have confiscatory taxing policies in many countries. The Albas have managed to be popular in spite of being so rich. And that, I think, to some extent, well, the two people have done it. One, the present Duke's grandfather, Jacobo, who was very aristocratic in his style.
The 17th Duke.
He made a point of being involved in lots of learned societies, a lot of cultural activities. He was on the board of trustees of many things. He tried to be involved. And then the Duchess, who just died at age 88 a few months ago, had a different tactic. She loved popular folklore. She loved the bullfights. She loved flamenco. And she loved some of the fairs of southern Spain and always would go out on horseback dressed in the appropriate way, some traditional Spanish way, or in her carriage. She was seen enjoying and participating with the people. And she herself said, of all the titles that she had, that the one she enjoyed the most was Duchess of the People.
You mentioned the title. That was one of the reasons she had so much attention when she died, is that she supposedly held the record, the Guinness World Record, for the number of titles.
Yes.
And that's an indication of the family's lineage, is it not?
And the good marriages.
Basically connected and connected and connected and,
exactly,
and connected.
Exactly.
She's also the one who you spoke of her love of horses. She also is one of the most unusual equestrian portraits, I think, in the exhibition. It's her as a young girl.
I love that picture. There's this little blonde girl, 4 years old, in a dress on top of her pony. And down in the corner, there's a little Mickey Mouse doll. I thought that was so cute.
There's a dachshund. And then there's, of all things, and it's, see,
couple
all this
dogs.
Nobility. This, and it's a painting from the 30s.
Uh-huh,
and there's
uh-huh.
Mickey Mouse.
Yes.
And it's
yes.
It seems so out of place there and so comical in a way. But it's but you can clearly see it's a little girl and it's her favorite doll.
Favorite toy, yeah. She was an only daughter. Her mother died of tuberculosis when she was 7 or 8. Her father was quite old when she was born. I think he was in his early 50s. And so she was kind of lonely when she was little. I mean, her father took good care of her, and there were aunts around, but she didn't have any brothers or sisters, and she didn't have a mother. And I suspect those toys meant a lot to her, and that dog, and those dogs, and that horse, you know.
You mentioned something earlier during the break that helped account for her popularity in the public image of the Albas. You said something about her holding parties.
Oh, she was a great hostess, and all kinds of people were invited to her homes. I remember when I was growing up, there were lots of pictures of Jackie Kennedy and Grace Kelly when she invited both of them at the same time to her house during one of the big fairs in southern Spain. But she had all kinds of important guests, and the one rule was we don't talk about politics at the table.
So there's no controversy erupting at her house.
Exactly. And she was on great terms with the socialist prime minister of Spain, Felipe González, who was also from Sevilla, and she lived half of the year in Seville. And they just got along famously. She was also on very good terms with the mayor of Madrid, who was an intellectual, Tierno Galván, who was more or less a socialist. They gave her honors and this, that, and the other, you know, the favorite, the most honored lady of Andalusia or Madrid's favorite lady, those kinds of things.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, and we will return to talk about the House of Alba, the art exhibition at SMU's Meadows Museum, in a minute after this break.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can learn how to design your own master's or doctoral degree at SMU, specializing in human rights, organizational dynamics, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
And we're back. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. And we are talking this hour about the Meadows Museum's landmark exhibition, The Treasures of the House of Alba from Spain. You can join the conversation by calling 800-933-5372, or you can email us at think@kera.org. And speaking of emails, this is from Mike, and he asks, given the prolonged, intense wars that prevailed throughout the 16th century, I think this is directed toward you, Kenneth, many firmly rooted in motives of economic gain and greater political hegemony, virtually all parties fighting under the banners of reformist commitments or Catholicism seem to have been particularly fierce. In this context, was the Duke d'Alba in every instance truly more brutal than his opponents?
I think the answer to that is no, that warfare was brutal in the 16th century, and the religious roots of some of these conflicts made it even more intense. He was clearly someone who believed in waging war even against civilians if he thought that they were in rebellion against the crown and against Catholicism.
A total war.
A kind of total war in that sense. So yes, he's more brutal than some of his successors were, For example, Don Juan of Austria was trying to, when he succeeded to become governor of the Netherlands, he tried to sort of arrange some sort of peace or some accommodation with the Duke of Orange and others. But Alba was not about that. And so on one level, he's a very stern, unyielding kind of person. And that lends itself to the imposition of these kinds of brutal methods, the Council of Troubles, for example, which tried lots of people and killed, including some of the leading nobles of the Netherlands.
I think that it's partly true in a way of, for lack of a better term, media image. The fact that he personally handled things like the Council of Troubles made him the face of the Spanish control.
And he was not at all shy about being the face of Spanish control. That was part of his personality, and it was part of his command and his way of dealing with the world. He was very direct, he was very forceful, and he was not tortured by self-doubt.
We were talking about this during the break, and I wanted to know that, I mean, the Meadows Museum is known, its mission is Spanish art. It's a repository of a tremendous collection of Spanish art. But there are galleries in this exhibition you can go into, and it doesn't strike you as Spanish art at all. There's Italian, there's German, there are Flemish tapestries. And I wanted to ask is there something that distinguishes the Albas as Spanish, if you looked at this collection? What does it say about them?
Well, I think one of the things you could say is that some of the paintings by famous Spanish artists like Goya clearly distinguish this as a Spanish noble house. But the other thing, ironically, is that one tends to think of different noble houses, particularly in Spain, as being isolated from cultural currents in Europe. And this just wasn't true of the House of Alba. It wasn't true of the great Duke of Alba, for example, in the 16th century. He was very well educated, and he was very well versed in artistic forms. He was constantly pestering Titian, for example, to give him paintings. So the cosmopolitan nature of the Spanish aristocracy is what you see reflected in this. And as I said, the popular image of Spain isn't that. The Spanish culture was much more isolated from the mainstream in Europe. And this really isn't true, certainly until you get to the 19th and 20th century.
But this is partly where the legend begins, is the battle with the Netherlands, is that they're seen as cruel and somehow they're primitive because of this.
Right, and I think part of the issue is that this goes back to a document written by William the Silent, the Duke of Orange, this Apologia, which is essentially a denunciation of Spain and Spanish cruelty and Spanish injustice. And they try and tar this image with Catholicism too and say, well, it's Catholicism that's responsible for all of this. And so Spain really is the epitome from the 16th century in Protestant Europe as the power that must be defeated. In fact, the Dutch used to say that they were going to make alliances with the indigenous peoples of the New World to overthrow the Spaniards. And in fact, in the 17th century, when they made landings in South America, they tried and failed to encourage the Chilean Indians to rise up against the Spaniards and support them, which was sort of a curious, curious detail. But no, I think that this so-called black legend of Spanish cruelty really begins in the 16th century and is used to discredit Spain through the Franco years.
You mentioned, Alexander, something else that distinguishes this collection immediately as Spanish, about the document.
I was very impressed by the archival documents there. For an example, there's a document from Alphonse X the Wise, the great patron of arts and sciences of the 13th century. I was also interested to see the will of Ferdinand the Catholic, that's Isabel's husband. I had no idea that the Albas had it. I didn't know such a thing even still existed. I was delighted. And also I was intrigued by the document ennobling and giving a coat of arms to Pizarro. Well, there were many Pizarros, but of course we're all thinking of the same one, the leader of the family in the Inca territory. And he was the founder of Lima. Last summer I went to Peru for the first time, and the first thing I went to do was go see his tomb. So I was very interested to see that he received this ennoblement so early on, just a few years after he founded Lima.
I was struck what you were saying, Kenneth, when we get to the 20th century, that the 17th Duke is portrayed, and he's quite cosmopolitan, dapper sort of. He looks like he's something out of a Broadway play at the time or something. He's in a black tuxedo with his hair slicked back, and he's sort of like the epitome of the 30s at the height. And I never thought of a Spanish Duke quite that way, tall and dashing. I was just wondering, is that part of his real character, or is that just a public image?
No, I think he saw himself as a man of the world, not as just as a man of Spain. He would have seen himself as, that's one of the reasons why he was so committed to collecting art and expanding the family's collection, because it was a reflection of the cosmopolitanism of the family and its nobility and its heritage. And so as a consequence, this would have been something that was exactly the kind of image he wanted to project of himself.
It looks like something out of Noel Coward, really.
He does. Yes.
He does.
Well, actually, if you see a picture of Alfonso XIII, who was the last king who was overthrown before the Spanish Civil War, one of the things you see is he looks very much like the English royal family, George V, for example. They almost could pass for twins. And so they're all related, interrelated to each other. So the fact is, members of the elite in Europe in the 19th and early 20th century were all very much people of their time. They didn't want to just see themselves as nationalists. One of the interesting things about Cayetana, the 18th Duchess of Alba, was that she was two things at once. She, on the one hand, she was definitely committed to all things Spanish, to popular art, to popular style, etc. At the same time, she wanted to be the center of a social life that included people from all over the world who were important, people like Princess Grace or Jacqueline Kennedy or others. And so there's this sort of cosmopolitanism that I think is part of the nobility's sense of themselves in this time period.
There's a portrait, I think it's of the 16th Duke, that it's really Edwardian. He's in a military uniform, and it's just a splendid portrait. Mm-hmm. But as soon as I saw it, I thought, that's what World War I wipes out, is all of that. But it didn't with the Albas, in a way. It's sort of strange. I mean, that's literally is what England loses that entire generation. The Romanovs lose it. The Germans lose it. But here he is looking still the Edwardian personification of a gentleman. And it didn't happen to the Albas.
No, it didn't, although their political influence certainly wanes. And they are committed as a family to public service. But you no longer see the Alba family at the center of power as you saw the third Duke in the court of Philip II. They are in many ways sort of cultural figures, iconic figures in society. And that role for them isn't really undermined terribly because they don't get involved in World War I. And they don't get involved in World War II either. And Franco derives a great deal of his legitimacy as well as some of his wealth and political support from the support of people like the Albas and other members of the Spanish elite. And so the elite really carries on in ways that it doesn't. It doesn't go through the kinds of transformations that some other parts of Europe do, although they're not part of the political establishment in the traditional sense.
But they don't become, in a way, dishonored by the slaughter of World War I.
No. Spain doesn't partake of World War I nor World War II. The Civil War is really the catharsis for Spain. And if the Republic had won the Civil War, then the Albas would have seen their lands confiscated. They would have seen their sources of wealth undermined. But they didn't. Franco did.
You may not be able to answer this question, but we speak of the wealth of the House of Alba. Where does their wealth reside these days? Because the Duke was quoted in the paper as saying, maintaining a collection like this costs a lot of money, just maintaining it. But they don't seem to be hurting, so.
Well, but, it's land ownership and real estate. I mean, to be crude about it, they have these palaces that are these incredibly, sumptuous palaces in Salamanca, two in Madrid, one in Sevilla. But they're expensive to maintain, and they don't produce a lot of revenue. And yes, land produces some revenue, but as we all know, farmers are frequently in debt. So land ownership in and of itself doesn't produce lots of liquid wealth. And so my suspicion is, and I'm not really a specialist on the history of the Alba family's finances, that really they had a they're sort of cash poor, and much of what they own requires a great deal of cash to keep going.
Well, as a matter of fact, I brought with me today two gifts to thank you. They're part of the Alba wealth, I'm assuming. You can get these at the gift shop. I got them because they're kind of unusual, along with the catalog, the impressive catalog, Treasures from the House of Alba. You can buy chocolate-covered figs, dried figs from the Alba's own estates.
How lovely.
And so I thought I'd present the two of them.
How they, lovely.
There's also, there are also bottles of extra virgin olive oil on sale from the House of Alba.
This is a new initiative they started in 2012 to try to commercialize some of their farm products. And I hadn't known about the figs covered in chocolate, but I had read some of their advertisements. They do have one other source of income, though, and that is they have a lot of urban real estate. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in Madrid pay rent to the Albas, and probably in many other towns also. So although they're huge landowners, they also have that other income, and that may be the buffer.
I'd also, I'm not sure where I read this, I'd also heard that one way that they help support these edifices is they kind of essentially loan them out to the city or to local organizations. In effect, if you help keep up the place, you get to use it for your special events.
Well, we've been talking about three or four palaces, but these people actually own 30 palaces and 20 castles. Now, some of these castles are in ruins. Some of these palaces are not too much more than what we would call townhouses, but they go back 400 years. They're Renaissance townhouses. And if they're in small villages, in many cases, the village, well, they only have one other nice building in that village, and that's the church. And so the villages a lot of times want to use those buildings for recreation centers.
The Grand Manor.
For recreation centers or for municipal town halls. And so they make deals. You know, we will put the money into restoring them if you'll let us use the building for 20 years, that kind of thing.
Now, the Duchess who died last year was something of a beloved figure. Do we know anything about the current holders of the titles?
The current Duke is divorced, and that's why you don't hear about a Duchess. Ah. The divorce came before he received the title of Duke. He had other titles. He was Duke of Westcott and other things. But that's why you don't hear of a current Duchess of Alba right now.
And he is the son of the Duchess?
Yes, the oldest son. There were six children. He's the oldest. So he's been preparing to be Duke for a long time. I think he's been running the family affairs for 15, 20 years, no? Yeah.
This exhibition, as I said earlier, is almost overwhelming in its scope. I was wondering if there's any particular painting other than the Fra Angelico that you found surprising.
Yes, I was just taken aback by a painting I didn't even know existed. I'd never seen a picture of it. And it's an equestrian, large painting. You may have seen it. It's in lots of shades of brown, of the Cardinal Infante. Mm-hmm. You saw it? The Cardinal Infante was King Philip IV's brother in the 17th century. He was the brother who went to war. I mean, he was the member of the family who became a general and actually died in Flanders. And I'm used to seeing a painting of his by Velázquez in which he's ready to go hunting.
Thank you, Alexandra. Thank you, Kenneth. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. We had help today on the phones from Lauren Ajire. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org.